Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, inadvertently, a show with two perspectives on whiteness and race. In moments, Asad Haider will talk about the limitations of fashionable critiques of white privilege. And then at the bottom of the hour, Lucinda Rosenfeld talks about her new novel, Class, which focuses on how the big questions of race and class are experienced by public school families in Brooklyn. At the beginning of the month, an article by the journalist Ned Reznikoff, "The Center Has Fallen and White Nationalism is Filling the Vacuum," appeared in Medium and lit up the social media for a few days. Reznikoff, who was once a leftist of sorts but has found his inner centrist along with a job at Think Progress, seems to think that there are deep affinities between the so-called Bernie Bro left and the white nationalist right. It's an incoherent piece. To call it badly argued would be to imply that it has an argument. But it is a symptom of a kind of thinking about race and politics that we've seen a lot of in recent years. Asad Haider, editor of Viewpoint magazine, has an article on that site that takes off from Reznikoff's piece and analyzes the discourse around white privilege. It's quite a fine essay, and here he is to talk about it. Asad Haider. We hear a lot about white privilege these days. It's sort of a penitential ritual across a good deal of the left these days. But I don't know, it does seem like a kind of, as you put it, solipsism, that everything is about whiteness all over again. Talk about precisely how this kind of concern with whiteness turns solipsistic, even in its left variant.
White privilege, the way that it's used today, is primarily about the behavior of whites. And as much as white people who use the term talk about deferring to people of color, leadership of people of color in political movements, the language of white privilege allows them to turn every political discussion towards a description of their own virtue. And that's not a substitute for politics. It's not an adequate substitute for politics, though it has turned out to be a very effective ideological substitute in the service of a different kind of politics. One phenomenon that you see coming out of this is that when people of color criticize the character of what is called identity politics, meaning a politics that is about the demands of a particular identity group, however that is defined, rather than about the change in some kind of political structure or some kind of project of emancipation. You find that when people of color criticize that, they're generally accused of being white, despite the fact that this politics is one which privileges personal experience, personal identity. It ends up completely effacing the experience and identity of the people who disagree and dissent. And it's about time we stopped allowing this to happen.
You mentioned one prominent example of this, that terrible piece by Ned Reznikoff, where he goes after the Jacobin magazine. I should say many of the Jacobin editors and contributors are my friends, so I have a personal stake in this. But Jacobin somehow becomes emblematic of the white left, even though its founder is certainly not white, and probably this second most important person in it also isn't. He's of Jamaican origin. So what do we make of this? Well, let's talk about that Reznikoff piece where he finds these deep affinities somehow between this white brochelist left and the alt-right. What's going on there?
What I'll say in response to that, the black communist Harry Haywood said the responsibility of comrades of color is to attack reactionary nationalism, and the responsibility of white comrades is to attack white chauvinism. That's a complicated project to engage in. I try to do my part on my side. And part of the problem with the discussion that Reznikoff is entering into is that the project of socialism cannot be framed in terms of whiteness. We have to attack the idea that there is such a thing as the white working class as a political agent that has to be defended or advocated for. I think if we make the understandable gesture in response to identity politics of saying, yes, but we also advocate for the white working class, we're making an error, because we are allowing the categories of socialist politics to be collapsed once again into identities. In fact, whiteness as a social construct is one that does not actually respond to people's cultural heritages or their certainly not their genetic lineages. It's a political construct which is based on a division within the working class, which is based on the idea that some workers can perceive an advantage in relation to other workers who are at a less advantaged position, and that there is no possibility of uniting around a common program. I think white comrades need to understand that that kind of category, the white working class, may be adequate for a census in which you check a particular box for race and you can define yourself according to a particular income. It's not an adequate category for politics. Politics has to be based on objective categories of analysis, and it has to look towards projects of universal emancipation. So I think we can't allow Reznikov and his ilk to set the debate by asking, what is our position on the white working class? That's an illusory category, and it's the wrong direction to go. The question is, what do we think about objective structures, like not only racial oppression, which is real, and with the rise of the extreme right, could be a serious problem, but also the problem of the overall structure of society, which is one that is based on exploitation and demands a unified response by the exploited.
Now, of course, whenever you bring up this sort of critique of the analysis of white privilege or criticize what perhaps people recklessly call identity politics, you're going to hear someone say, well, you're ignoring the reality of racism and sexism. How do you plead to that charge?
Once again, it's easier to make that charge when you can get away with describing me as white. I am not white, and I might even be placed on a list very soon. We'll see what happens. So at a personal level, that doesn't hold water. At the political level, it's even more offensive to me, because I think that one of the most precious legacies in American history is when people who struggled against racial oppression, predominantly African Americans, but also other racial groups in the United States, these people very consistently, the militants engaged in this struggle, came to realize that it was impossible to achieve liberation. It was impossible to overcome racial oppression without also extending towards anti-capitalism. And in my article, I quote W.E.B. Du Bois making this point. I quoted him from 1961, though he came to this realization in the 30s. But it's even more pronounced when we look at the legacy of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movements, when people realize that after achieving the reforms, the legislative reforms that were aimed at by the civil rights movement that had to do with legal racial discrimination, the project was not finished. Racial oppression persisted, and at the same time, it was defined by a serious economic exploitation. And it was only possible to achieve emancipation by attacking that as well. And that was only possible by expanding the project to one that included the working class as a whole. And so I think that if we're serious about our history, if we take seriously the struggles of people who have fought racial oppression in the past, then we cannot possibly engage in this kind of red baiting in which people who take an anti-capitalist position are accused of not taking race seriously. You will have to say that about W.E.B. Du Bois, about the Black Panthers, about a whole range of other groups that also held anti-capitalist positions.
Now, you quote the Du Bois passage where he famously talks about the psychological wage. How is what you're saying different from what he was arguing with that concept?
It's a question to what extent that's that is a concept or a kind of casual description of something that's happening. I certainly don't think that the analysis Du Bois proposes is reducible to psychology. Now, one of the core problems of identity politics, and I think that the term is appropriate because we're talking about identity as the experience of the self, as the cohesion of the self. In identity politics, that's the starting point of politics. And I'm proposing that, along with Du Bois, we can't start with that to come up with an effective analysis or an effective political program. We need to start with an analysis of the composition of society, of the structures that are historically constructed that constitute different hierarchies among people, that produce labor markets, that produce forms of extra economic coercion. That's what Du Bois analyzed. And it was on that basis that he came to see the psychological wage that the white worker received as a barrier to the white worker's own liberation. That is, that by receiving particular privileges at a cultural level, at the level of status, the white worker was unable to realize the fundamental problem of economic exploitation that united them with the black workers.
That was one of the lasting achievements of the Southern planter class. Now, you contrast Du Bois with a very famous essay by Peggy McIntosh, in which she unpacks her knapsack of white privilege. Talk about what that article and what is wrong with it.
Right. Well, let me say, I am sure that Peggy McIntosh is a very nice and well-intentioned person. I would imagine that that article has resulted in more decent behavior among white people that I have personally benefited from. Having said that, I don't think we can accept it as a political analysis. It's certainly true that at the level of individual behavior, conversations, if I were to go into a rural gas station a decade ago, it would have been a somewhat anxious experience, which it is not now. And I'm sure we can credit people like McIntosh for the changes that is the result of. However, at the same time, McIntosh employs certain conceptual frameworks that I think make it impossible to really understand the nature of race in American society, of this social construct which is race, and the nature of different forms of domination that a political program might try to attack. McIntosh sort of takes race for granted. It's equated with her skin color, and that's equated with a particular group of people that she has a common culture with. She talks about being in the company of people of my race. She talks about listening to the music of my race. Her privileges are that she can do those things, whereas people of other races presumably cannot. Well, I think the problem is that we can't accept this equation of race with skin color. We know that the white race, for example, is constituted of many different groups which once were not considered to be equal and equivalent or part of a common heritage. Irish people, Italians, people from the Russian Empire were in their various migrations often subjected to discrimination comparable to the discrimination that non-whites have experienced. So this racial category is one that is constituted not based on something which is not reducible to skin color, but which is based on a particular way of categorizing people. You have to look at the history of how that happens. And if you do the way Du Bois did and the way others have, you find that it emerges from the ruling class response to the threat of labor solidarity.
I'm speaking with Assad Haider, who's the editor of Viewpoint magazine. You talk about how the theory of white skin privilege was advanced by a group that split off from the Communist Party. We have Ted Allen, Noel Ignatieff. Could you talk about that intellectual tradition?
Right. Well, you can date it back. I quoted Harry Haywood earlier, who was the the author of the Black Belt thesis, the idea of a black nation in the south of the United States, is an idea that's often ridiculed today because it seems ridiculous to say that black people are a nation. It's not more self-evident, I think, to say that black people are a race. Both of these are mystifying categories that have to be explained. And the idea of the Communist Party in the 20s and 30s was that if we don't take up these demands that black people are making against legal segregation, against racial discrimination, then they will join separatist movements like those of Marcus Garvey. We need to say that our group, which is one composed of many nationalities, is one that will fight against the unique oppression they experience. And that, Ted Allen said, was the first theory of race as a social construction. I think he makes a convincing argument there. So Ted Allen and Noel Ignatieff, both members of the Provisional Organizing Committee, which split off from the Communist Party USA. Noel Ignatieff later is a participant in the debates in SDS, particularly in 68-69, when it's debating Marxism and sort of coming apart at the seams. So the idea that Ignatieff and Allen set out was that the black movement, the black nationalist movement, and the movements against white supremacy have to be understood not as movements which are external to the working class movement, which the labor movement may decide to support or not to support, etc., but actually they're part of the program of the working class itself, because as long as this division exists within the working class, as long as some white workers can feel that they have a higher status because they are not black, as long as black workers see white workers as a kind of labor aristocracy, it will be impossible to have a united working class that can end the structure of capitalist exploitation itself. And this was the beginning of the theory of what at the time they called white skin privilege. And it's amazing how it's been almost completely reversed.
Yeah, you mentioned how the Weathermen, how they took this up, and they abandoned white workers as any kind of revolutionary force, and took the revolutionary burden upon themselves.
Yeah, the Weatherman document, You Don't Need a Weatherman to Know Which Way the Wind Blows, which was one tendency in SDS. Ignatieff was a member of Revolutionary Youth Movement 2, which was sort of the alternative to that, and they harshly criticized the ideas of the Weatherman tendency, which said that white people had to, in effect, kind of destroy their own privilege by becoming a support for the armed insurrection of people of color and third world people around the world. This was always rejected by black radicals, and the argument that Revolutionary Youth Movement 2 made in response, even though it's not as widely read now, is, I think, quite definitive. It's probably not as widely read because it didn't result in this kind of glamorous, romantic underground life that the Weatherman tendency ended up in. And that's a very appealing fantasy, I suppose, for guilty white liberals.
Well, now we've just been through a presidential election and the early phases of the Trump horror, in which many of the things we've been talking about have taken on real, very powerful material manifestations. I mean, we had the primary campaign where Hillary's people used a critique of whiteness and brutalism to advance her neoliberalism. And now we've been watching a lot of high-minded white people like Ned Resnikoff condemning all those bad white people who voted for Trump. This is real practical stuff. This is not just highfalutin theory.
Right. Well, I think this is once again an area in which we have to reject the category of the white working class as some kind of unitary political agent. Trump lost the popular vote. We know from the research that political science has conducted for a long time, people like Larry Bartels, Morris Fiorina, et cetera, that the white working class, defined by income, has a tendency to vote for the Democrats, more likely to vote for the Democrats. So this illusion that, you know, the kind of Meryl Streep crowd has, that there are these ugly people out there who are ignorant and resentful, and they vote for Trump because of their lack of education and their poverty. It's really a fiction. Now, at the same time, certainly, when you had the New York Times and everybody else projecting that Trump had a 96% chance of losing and he won, obviously there is a problem there, which also includes this white working class. And that has to be understood. But it's not going to be understood by creating this monolithic unit, which has nothing to do with people's actual political behavior, with their voting behavior, and with their views. And, you know, I don't know why we have all these young left-wing people who are working as baristas in New York City, and I don't know why they don't move to North Dakota and buy a house and start talking to people and linking up with the people in North Dakota who voted for Bernie in the primary and figure things out and make something of that.
The coffee probably isn't as good, though.
They can bring the coffee. You know, they can mail order the coffee. They can make their money through Etsy. And I think it'll work.
Yes, they can make pussy hats or whatever for the next one. Well, you end the piece by quoting a very famous passage from Du Bois, capitalism cannot reform itself. With Trump now in office, we run the risk. Well, there are two things going on at once. It seems like there's a great political possibility of building a left in opposition to this because the Democrats are not up to the task. But on the other hand, the risk is that the progressive neoliberals will come back in and say, we can reform capitalism because we're the only alternative to this horrible fascist. So help us navigate these seas in the coming years.
Well, one important lesson that we have to draw from the abject failure of the Democrats in this campaign and the total incoherence of liberals now, who will do anything but acknowledge that they failed, that their lesser evilism turned out to be the most impractical position. The lesson that we need to take from that is that it is no longer acceptable to hide an anti-capitalist position. It is no longer acceptable to say that, we're anti-capitalist, but we set it aside for the moment because people aren't ready for it, because we have to defeat the right. It won't happen. It won't happen because this, what you call progressive neoliberalism, actually engenders the extreme right, and it creates these problems and is impotent against them. And it's now a responsibility. This is why the rhetoric of white privilege, of identity politics, is so irresponsible now. It's irresponsible because it prevents us from creating the kind of unified program and the kind of mass movement that could actually defeat something like a Trump presidency, the alt-right, and whatever is left of the Republican Party in the future. The only way to defeat these awful developments is building a mass movement that attacks the very structure of the capitalist system. There's no alternative.
Well, you'd almost suspect that perhaps unconsciously a lot of the people who traffic in this discourse of white privilege realize that they have no prescription for changing the world, so they just want to feel superior to everyone else.
Well, I think many of them would prefer that the world not be changed because, you know, it's very, it's a lot of fun to criticize Trump. It's a lot of fun to make fun of poor people when you make so much money and have such a nice job. So I don't see why they would want anything to change.
They don't like to be reminded of that, though.
Let's see if I ever get a job now.
Okay, good luck. Thank you. I was Asad Haider, editor of Viewpoint magazine, viewpointmag.com on the web, and author of the article White Purity on that site. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the seventh of the eight pieces for piano by the mid-20th century Austrian composer Hans Eisler, performed by Matthew Rubinstein. And now a fiction writer, a rarity here on Behind the News. Lucinda Rosenfeld is just out with her fifth novel, Class, set in an unnamed but unmistakable Brooklyn, specifically its affluent and gentrifying sections. It might strike many unfamiliar with the curious life of that borough as rather foreign territory. The intensely competitive nature of the public school system, for example, where battles of race and class are fought out every day. Since public funding of the educational system, already stingy, is under constant pressure, schools do their best to raise money from parents and other sources. In my own kids' elementary school, the librarian, the Spanish teacher, and the substitute teachers are all funded by money raised by the PTA. In schools attended by poor children, the PTA is lucky to be able to raise pocket change. Rosenfeld turns all this and more into a marvelous satirical novel. Lucinda Rosenfeld. This must be really foreign territory for a lot of people who do not live in Brooklyn. I remember describing the middle school application process to my sister-in-law who lives in Massachusetts, and she said, well, here up in Mediocreville, we only have one middle school. So could you just lay out the social landscape that this book is set in?
Well, the book is set in, I purposely did not name it as Brooklyn. Now my friends who know me and people who live here will probably quickly identify it as Brooklyn, Brownstone Brooklyn. But I did in the book purposely leave it kind of open. However, the landscape here in Brooklyn is, well, thanks in part to Bloomberg's policies, school choice, which obviously came in with Bloomberg, means that you have a local elementary school, but if you want to play the system and you know how to play the system, you can get your kids into a better school if your local zoned elementary school isn't the one you want. So there's a lot of jockeying and movement around which school you get. And, you know, like everywhere, property values are connected with the school zone and all that jazz. And then middle school is incredibly competitive and ends up separating the races even more than the elementary schools already do via real estate.
Yeah, and given the choice mechanisms, you don't even need to find a discarded utility bill in the trash.
Yes, well, yeah, my heroine of my novel, Karen, she wants to play fair, and she enrolls her kids in the zoned elementary school, which is a mixed school, which is at the very early stages of gentrification, so it has a minority white population. And then she decides that she can't deal with it. And I'm not going to give the plot away, but she finds some stuff in the trash that will get her into another school. And I have heard versions of this story in real life, people doing stuff like that. There's lots of lying going on, which is really just a sad commentary on the whole system, really.
Yeah. I was chatting with a friend of mine who lives in Grosse Pointe the other day, and he says the Grosse Pointe school system does twice yearly checks to make sure people live where they say they do.
That's amazing. I don't know if there's actually ever been house checks. I heard that PS29 in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, actually was going to start house checks because they were overcrowded. It sounds really terrifying.
I think a lot of people outside New York do not realize that we have some extremely good public schools here and some extremely bad ones. And, you really have to work the system in order to, unless you have a luck of geography, you have to work the system to get your kid into one of the better schools.
Yeah, my aunt and uncle were here in the 70s on the Upper West Side. And my understanding is that affluent families began in the spirit of the 70s using the public schools, and things reversed in the 80s. And the public school system went back to being almost entirely minority and poor. And so the launch of things like gifted and talented programs and stuff under Bloomberg, and people and a lot of families choosing to stay in the city, brought back the public schools. So you in New York, you have, you know, quite a large number of affluent white and Asian people using the public schools, which is a change from 20 years ago. So the book takes place in this milieu where it's not simply affluent people using private schools and poor people who can't afford it using public schools. There are desirable public schools all over the city near affluent areas. And so the heroine of the book is grappling with this and grappling with her consciousness about, do I seek out the all-white school, or do I believe in integration and diversity and enroll my daughter in the mixed school down the block? That's sort of the conundrum of the book.
And as a little detour, when you live in a neighborhood like the one I live in, you start thinking everybody is rich or everybody is getting rich. But then you look at the census statistics and, you know, it's not there. I mean, the average income in this neighborhood is $75,000, which is about 50% higher than the national median. But, you know, this is not the rich by any stretch of the imagination. So, but everybody in New York thinks that everybody else is rich or something.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. And I mean, the private schools are, you know, over $40,000 a year. So some of this desperation over placing your kids in public school is born of those people in the middle class or lower upper middle class or whatever you want to call them, who can't actually afford those private schools. But, you know, they still want like a desirable education for their kids with lots of extras and arts programs and whatnot. So there's that desperation that's always built into the upper middle class. I don't know. I don't know what you call $75,000 a year in New York. Is that upper middle class, middle class?
It's hard to say what that is. But even by national standards here, what, maybe at the 70th percentile of the income distribution, you're not rolling in it. I mean, you're certainly comfortable and you can certainly get your teeth fixed, but you're not jetting off to the Caribbean for a weekend.
A friend of mine is a professor in Rochester, New York, and I think her house cost $12,000 or something. She bought a Victorian house. So, I mean, you can be affluent on $75,000. Just not here.
You're right. A friend of mine once quoted to me something a friend of his said. She was a longtime activist, progressive activist in Los Angeles, and suddenly found herself in the Los Angeles school board. And she said, when it comes to schooling and their children, parents will forget all their politics and do just about anything to do the best for their kids. But this seems to be that, you know, the dilemma that many of your characters are struggling with.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's this primal thing about your own children and they come out of you, especially for a woman. And it's like the politics come up against that. It's kind of like feeling that you're protecting, you know, furthering the species or protecting the next generation or whatnot. So it's like politics get kind of like thrown into, you know, I don't know, it's all magnified somehow when it comes to your own children, I think, because it's very easy to talk about things like integrated schools and diversity. But then when you're placing your child and your white person in a minority white class, I have been there and my own personal experience. And it's trippy, you know, in a world where for white people, you're mostly always in a white world, more or less, and you're used to being in the majority and you're suddenly in an environment that's minority white. It's very much of a mind trip. This is what I experienced, at least at my daughter's public school. Walking into kindergarten for the first day, I thought, cool. And I thought, wow, this is really scary and weird, you know, simultaneously.
Yeah. And we should say, which I think you said before I hit the record button, that although this is identifiably a Brooklyn, you know, brownstone Brooklyn milieu, this is not a letter for letter translation from your experience.
No, it's not, because my daughter's public school, and I don't want to name it, it has quite a large middle class and affluent white and Asian and even people of color population at this point. I mean, at least I would say 50% of the school is from middle class and above families. And the school in the book, that is the first half of the book, called Betts, is a school that's at the very early stages of gentrification. And so it's white people who are either uncomfortable and going to leave, or who are making a very determined decision to be the newcomers kind of thing and are comfortable with that in some way.
Your heroine, Karen Kippel.
Yes.
And that name is slightly comical.
all the names in my books are comical. I can't help it.
They're very good ones.
I love names.
You have fun with her, but she's not a bad person, and you know you really don't tear at her. Describe her character and how you see her in this the conflict she's facing.
Well, she is well-meaning, but she's constantly in conflict with herself, and she's basically a middle-aged white woman who, as we all get older, we seek comfort in some way, I think. You know, it's like adventure is fun, but comfort is really nice. And so she's has these two conflicting sides of her personality, one who's committed to social justice and who works for this hunger relief charity and who wants a better world and wants to see mixed schools, which, as we all know at this point, are a rarity in New York State and in the country, really. Increasingly a rarity. I mean, I think the school systems across the country are more segregated than they were in the 80s. And then she has this other side of her, when we talked about the sort of primal protect your kids. And also she's middle-aged. And when we get middle-aged, you know, you don't want things that are hard and challenging always. That's people get soft, right? So she's battling these two forces inside herself the whole book. And she gives in halfway through the book. Without giving the plot away, she sort of gives in to her fears and takes a new direction with her daughter and sort of pays the price and makes a lot of trouble. I'm not going to give the book away. But I think that, you know, I'm fascinated with Amazon reviews because you really hear what people really think as opposed to what critics think. And it's always the same with all the characters in my book. Like, some people say, oh, I totally identified with this person. And the other people say, she's so self-absorbed and so irritating. But, you know, I think if you get into the head of any actual human being, they're really self-absorbed and irritating because there are thoughts that go through your head contradicting each other all the time. Or, you know, if you actually enumerated them, I think you would probably find everybody really irritating. Because aren't we all day long making calculations about what we should do and how we should act? I probably, the mistake in my book is I spell too many of them out. It probably gets irritating at some point.
She is, for all her silliness, also trying to navigate a very contradictory world. It's very hard to retain your principles in a world that constantly assaults them. And when it comes to the kind of school you send your kid to, it's really hard to make a decision that you might want to have to defend before a large audience.
I mean, schools are also in cities like New York, they're status symbols. You know, they're ways that, you know, I go to a cocktail party and people say, oh, where do your, you know, sometimes like the third question, oh, where do your kids go to school? Like, it's the weirdest idea. You know, somehow it's an extension of my brand, where my kids go to school, which I just find that so strange, really.
Well, it's related to real estate, like everything in New York.
Yes, it's related to real estate. One of the things that inspired me to write the book was that I was struck in the last, you know, having lived in Brownstone, Brooklyn for a lot of years now, by the shocking contradictions in the people I know who live in my neighborhood, so to speak. The kind of the disconnect between these incredibly liberal values they're espousing and yay gay marriage, yay Obama, yay all this identity politics stuff, and then their own lifestyles, which are like totally elitist often. And in my experience, and this sort of motivated me to write the book, you know, often sending their kids to, whether public or private, entirely white affluent schools, and then, you know, ranting and raving on Facebook about equal rights and Obama and blah, 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 and how proud they are of the first family. And so I was kind of shocked by this, and it got under my skin in some way that, you know, that there is this, I guess for everybody, and I'm no purist, and I incriminate myself at the same time, but there's this, seems like a lot of people in these liberal enclaves are walking around saying one thing and doing another, or just constantly in conflict with themselves. You know, they're obsessed with like nutrition and food. Food politics is a big part of the book, but so horrified by poor people's food, but then acting very sympathetic about the poor people who eat it, but, you know, really dismissive of fast food.
Yeah, well, I recall there was a discussion on my kids' preschool listserv about the trans fats in the cupcakes you get at the Pathmark. So, I mean, that
sounds like an outtake from my book. Yeah, that sounds exactly right. Like, so, you know, everybody's so concerned about food justice and, you know, pesticides and all this stuff. And then, like, it turns out organic food costs a fortune and like poor people can't afford it. So food becomes this whole class issue. And there's this like huge snobbery towards the kind of people who bring Pathmark cupcakes to school for their kids' birthdays. We've had a lot of that in my daughter's school.
I'm speaking with Lucinda Rosenfeld, who's the author of Class from Little Brown. But I do wonder why food becomes such a central issue for so many of these sort of affluent, liberal, guilty parents. I guess it's something they can control.
I don't know. You know, I did not grow up in a foodie household. I grew up in a snobby, culturally snobby household, but we ate Twix bars. And my husband's the same. He did not grow up with fancy food. And it kind of got to me at some point, and I became one of those annoying people who won't go to Dunkin' Donuts, and I'd rather spend twice as much and get like an artisanal donut or something because I'm a victim. But I don't know how food took off in the last 20 years as this art form or whatever it is. I mean, I hate cooking, but some of this thinking got to me. It's such a symptom of like the end of the Roman Empire, isn't it? That like everybody's running around like being excited about some recipe or something. I don't know. I've never been interested in food. It seems like such a diversion, and corporate farming is horrible. I get it. And I don't eat Purdue chickens because I found out what they did to the chickens and stuff. But you know, you can't be a purist in the world. And that sort of goes to the heart of my book too, which is, you know, it's impossible. You would basically have to put yourself in a geodesic dome or something to live a pure life. I mean, we're being accosted by chemicals every time we step outside. You can't live a life without plastic. You can't live a life without pesticides. We're all screwed already, as far as I can tell.
Yes, I love that woman's tantrum over the Ziploc bags.
Oh, the Ziploc lady, yes.
But I once read a quote from someone where she said, I can't control anything that goes on in the world outside, but at least I can control what goes into me.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting. I mean, women got really obsessed with their bodies in the last 25 years. And I wonder if that's new. Like if you went back in time 50 years, would women be so worried about their bodies? Is it something about modern fashions that make you have to be worried? Or that actually makes sense to me. This sort of control over the environment and what enters your body thing, that does seem to be a modern phenomenon. I think it speaks of anxiety in a general sense too about the world.
Returning to the topic of your novel, I mean, these parents really can't have that much of an influence on the world around them. You know, the school system shaped by very, very large forces. There's not much they can do about it, so they have to just do what they can to deal with it. And for all their absurdity, they're really dealing with a very difficult situation. If they have anything like a political conscience, it's very hard to live in that world.
Right. Well, I mean, Bloomberg left us a way more segregated school system than I believe came before. On the other hand, a lot of middle-class families entered the school system under his three terms. And you could say that's a positive thing because where middle-class and upper-middle-class parents show up to the schools, they bring resources. They bring PTA funding and arts programs and whatnot. So, I mean, you know, from my own experience, and my kids are actually at a very rare integrated school, by which I mean it actually is authentically mixed in a way that is shocking. And I think your kid's school probably sounds the same way. But these are rarities, and most parents find themselves looking at a system where you go along with a herd and you find yourself an apartment in the white neighborhood with the white school, or you're some kind of maverick and you decide it's okay for your kid to be the one, let's say, white child in, you know, a class or something like that, and you're going to go for it and be the maverick. And, you know, most people don't want to be the one only anything. And it turns out black families don't want to be the one black family in a white school either. I've had this confirmed. I did a panel with Nicole Hannah Jones, and she confirmed the same feeling as me, which was no one wants to show up at kindergarten and find they're the one something.
I once met a CUNY professor who lived in the East Village around some very fine schools, but deliberately sought out a school in the East Harlem that was quite bad by conventional measures for his kid because he thought that's the way to pursue social justice. But that's like one in a million who would do something like that.
I know some people in London who grew up in London, and their parents thought it would be really cool as a lefty experiment to send them to a school where they were the only affluent family in the entire school, or white family, or whatever. I think it's different in London. The color line is different, but and it usually doesn't go well for the kids, but it makes the parents feel good. I mean, and that's the thing too. Like, you have to respond to your kids. You know, you have to give them an environment where they're going to feel happy too. And unfortunately, I would argue, actually, kids don't see, in my experience, kids don't see color, but they see social class in some way, and they pick up signifiers, and they do not want to be the only kid who does certain kinds of things on the weekend. They want kids who have reference points like them. They may not see the color of your skin, but they seek out, in my experience, kids from the same socioeconomic class as them at a shockingly young age, in my experience.
Yeah, I've been stunned by the speed and skill with which my kid learned to pick up social class markers.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, they're like baby sociologists.
Yeah. Now, I wrote about this in the Times style section a month ago, but my younger daughter went to kindergarten. She was 5, and she came home and announced she had a best friend. And I looked at the class list, and the guy was an editor at Norton, the dad. I mean, she found like the one family in publishing in the whole class, and he was really shy and barely spoke. How she like found this kid, I don't understand. They're still friends.
Like, brainwaves or something.
Decide that the family of writers, how did she find the other family of writers? That just blew my mind.
I found myself being somewhat jealous of you in reading the book, because, you know, this, you're dealing with very profound political, you know, conundrums of political economy and social relations. And yet you wrote this very stylish, amusing, charming satire.
Oh, thank you, Doug.
So, you know, satire, you can't solve any problems with satire.
No, I don't have any solutions. I don't even pretend to have any solutions. But thank you. I grew up reading some Kurt Vonnegut. I used to love it. I don't know. I don't know if it's aged well. I haven't opened. Have you opened a Vonnegut book lately?
Oh, good God. It's been decades.
Okay. So there you go. Me too. You know, I think of myself as an entertainer more than anything else. I don't really aspire to more than that. My previous books were less overtly political. I stuck to more kind of smaller canvases, and I'm fascinated with relationships between women. I don't mean sexual ones. I mean like the bizarre intricacies of friendships and sisters and whatnot. So this is my most overtly political book, but I like a good yarn, like everybody, and you know, a good affair thrown in there, which I did in this book too.
Yes, I did want to get too deeply in that, so as not to spoil the.
I don't want to. But you know, in my own life too, I actually I tried to paint a pretty broad canvas in this book, and in my own life too, like we were saying before. We hit the record button. You know, I have friends who, I sort of pride myself on having friends or acquaintances in a large group of people among a giant array along a large spectrum of people. I mean, I know some hedge fund people. I wouldn't say they're my best friends, but you know, I like to dabble in different worlds a little bit. It interests me, if nothing else, to converse with people who are not part of the liberal bubble. I mean, look, most of my peeps are liberal bubble, but you know.
Did you take that Charles Murray test?
No, does he have a liberal bubble test? That sounds awesome.
Oh yes, it's quite amazing. It's very telling and.
Really?
Yes.
He
got me right, and he also got the difference between me and my wife Liza right. He knew that she had a more distinguished pedigree than I do.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's quite a test.
Oh, I'm not, but, my pedigree is not as distinguished as my sisters have much higher pedigrees than me. I don't have no graduate degrees, and I went to Cornell in an era where it was really easy to get in there. I have much fancier sisters, but
she comes from a family of academics, and I'm just a jerk from suburban New Jersey.
Oh, we need to talk then, because I'm from suburban New Jersey too. Although we were kind of the weirdos in the suburbs, I don't know if that applies.
Yeah, well, we're weirdos for different reasons. But so this experience of political satire—are you going to go back for more, or is this?
I think that I might go back for more. I make no claims from my earlier books. I think this is my best book in years. As I get older, I'm more aware of the world around me, and I'm hoping that shows up in my books. I think I'm going to keep the kind of broad canvas Whatever you think of Tom Wolfe, and he's basically a reactionary, right? You know, that the Bonfire of the Vanities book, have you read that in 20 years? Probably not.
No, I haven't looked at it since it came out.
Yeah, okay. Well, I looked at it not that long ago. You know, it's obviously very dated, the references, but I do admire the way, and it's reactionary and everything like that, but I admired the way he really attempted to get a big cross-section of characters and social classes and whatnot in there, even if it's racist. So I'd like to keep going with the larger canvas kind of thing. But I don't know. Every time I finish a book, I think, that was, how did I do that? I'm never going to be able to do that again. And I'm slightly interested in Obsession right now, which is not a political topic. That might be my next book. Make of that what you will.
That was Lucinda Rosenfeld, author of Class, just out from Little Brown. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Twice, beginning with a 2 instead of a T, from Mission of Burma. Till next week, bye.